What happened to music that meant something?
The Who at the Kingdom or Kiss at the Coliseum. Where is the Misty Mountain Hop? Where is the smoke on the water? Where is the Iron Man of today?
Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kott. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, we welcome singer-songwriter and Kinks frontman Ray Davis.
Plus, we'll review the new albums from Tokyo Police Club and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time for some music news.
Something happened for the very first time with you. My heart melted to the ground, found something true. And everyone's looking round, thinking I'm going crazy.
Greg, that is Leona Lewis and a song called Bleeding Love. It was a number one single a week or so ago, and it made history. Only the third ever chart-topping U.S. single by a British woman. It follows Petula Clark's Downtown in 1965 and Sheena Easton's Morning Train, 9 to 5, in 1981. Who is this young woman? She's 23 years old, been groomed her entire life, basically from the womb, to become a pop star. Sylvia Young Theatre School in the UK, the Italia Conti Academy, the Brit School, and then she goes on this TV show called X Factor. X Factor, which was launched as Pop Idol, is the British TV contest that inspired American Idol. Both of these programs have as a central character the irascible Simon Cowell. And Simon Cowell and Clive Davis of J Records put their names on as executive producers on her debut album, and this was supposed to be one of the pop phenoms of the year, following only to the obvious American Idol, Mariah Carey.
Yeah, indeed. Mariah's got her new album out this week, Jim, coincidence that it is. It's called E equals MC squared, her 11th studio album.
I love that title.
And as you said, there would be no Leona Lewis without Mariah Carey. I think we look back on Mariah Carey's debut album back in 1990, it started a cycle that has taken us through American Idol and now Leona Lewis, and a particular style of oversinging that has become the standard by which we judge singers and the standard by which top 40 hits are made. This is why Simon Cowell and Clive Davis right now are probably the two most important men in the mainstream music industry. They are the talent scouts who are basically taking this type of music and putting a lot of money behind it and shooting it up the charts. What's interesting to me is that the Leona Lewis record sold only 205,000 copies in its first week. I mean, the way this record was being hyped, between the amount of money that was sunk into the marketing campaign, the appearance on the Oprah Winfrey show in which Oprah proclaimed, "A star is born."
Yeah, she said, "You are the follower now to Whitney Houston and Mariah Carey."
And they have 205,000 sales to show for it.
That's a very anemic number one showing.
Absolutely. I mean, we were talking about a record that was being hyped as a million seller.
And 2 years in the making, because she won that X Factor contest 2 years ago. They were waiting for the precise moment to launch her career.
So we've seen this American Idol phenomenon blow up. Now we've seen Leona Lewis as the greatest example of a great singer, quote-unquote, coming out of this hit factory, and the record's a dud. Now, Carey, who had her problems a few years ago when her Glitter movie tanked, she had a nervous breakdown, she made a huge comeback a few years ago with The Emancipation of Mimi.
I can't understand. That record was awful, and it sold 5 million copies.
And what we have, again, is Mariah Carey, the queen of oversinging. She's now in her late 30s. You know, the high notes aren't always there anymore for her. Has made another record that sounds quite a bit like her previous records, except the shrill high notes aren't there in as much abundance. And it'll be interesting to see what the Carey record does now. Because what I see here, Jim, is this trend is starting to peter out. The fact that only 200,000 people bought this Lewis record, to me, is an encouraging sign that people are getting tired of this type of singing and this type of promotion.
Greg, in the interest of saving listeners the trouble of actually having to play any of it themselves, let's play a little bit of Mariah Carey's first single, which, by the way, is her 18th number one. She has now displaced Elvis Presley and is second only to the Beatles, who have 20 number one hits. What kind of world do we live in where Mariah Carey is nipping at the heels of the Beatles? I don't know. But here is some of her new album on Sound Opinions. You've been waiting for it, I'm waiting too. In my imagination, I be all up on you. I know you got that fever for me, 102. And boy, I know I feel the same, my temperature's through the roof. If it's a camera up and hidden, it's only you would be when I do. If it's a camera up and hidden, I best like I just click on YouTube. Close up your on your mouth and brag about the secret rendezvous. I will hunt you down. My business like a Wendy interview. But this is private between you and I. Touch my body, put me on the floor. You're listening to Sound Opinions.
In the daytime, girl, I want to be with you all of the time. The only time I feel alright is by your side. Girl, I want to be with you all of the time, all day and all of the night. All day and all of the night. All day.
All Day and All of the Night from the Kinks, the song that put the Kinks and the songwriter Ray Davis on the map in the mid-60s. Ever since, Ray Davis has written some of the great songs in rock and roll. Ray Davis, that's the way he prefers to have his name pronounced. Ray Davis, one of the great songwriters of all time. He stopped by our studio to perform songs from his latest solo record, Working Man's Cafe.
We are here with, no exaggeration and no hyperbole, a rock and roll legend, Ray Davis of the Kinks, touring behind only his second ever solo album, Working Man's Cafe. Ray, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Let's start with that. All these years, all this music, career that spans five decades, only two solo albums.
Yeah. I know. It's when I got to do it, I realized I didn't have an identity. So I've been looking for that for the last couple. It is a different, totally different dynamic coming to a solo record, because I know I wrote the songs for the Kinks, but it's like they were a muse, and I knew them as players, and it was easy to do. When you're a solo artist, it's unknown territory. Very strange.
Do you find yourself writing differently, Ray, when your name's on the record as opposed to the Kinks?
There's more. I get the blame for it all. With the Kinks, you know, if you do a bad show or you make a bad record, say, yeah, the drummer was really bad tonight. when it's a solo record, there's no excuses. Yeah, it's. But I'm gradually finding people I can lay blame at. People, you know, Clive Davis, who's one of my old label guys I worked with at Arista, he said, always maintained that group records sell much more than solo records. And they're a total different discipline, you know, because I think people think that the words and the music really is my personal opinion, and a lot of it is. But with a band, I wrote through characters, you know. I did all these different songs. All Day and All of the Night is a different, almost a different persona to Waterloo Sunset and Sunny Afternoon. But I think it's even more, the perception is that it's all my first person opinion. I find that I'm more of an actor going into a role when I do a song with the Kinks.
I am a dull and simple lad. Cannot tell water from champagne. And I have never met the Queen. And I wish I could have all he has got. And I wish I could be like David was.
Now I have to actually make it more focused to the way I feel.
It's interesting that you say that, Ray, because your songwriting has always been full of these very memorable characters, David Watts or whoever, right? And it seems to me that you found your way into your solo career by being a writer, like us, a mere writer, like Greg and I, doing the storyteller shows where you would tell the stories behind some of the songs and writing your autobiography, X-Ray. And then, lo and behold, a couple of years after that, we got your first solo album.
Yeah, well, the storyteller things came as a, started as a book reading. I did X-Ray first, this, the unauthorized autobiography.
Yeah.
And then I was doing book readings, you know, at bookshops just to sell the book. And I decided to throw some songs in, and that evolved into Storyteller, which sort of blew up into some sort of big TV show. And I went on tour. I toured with it for about 3 or 4 years, and it became a big part of my life.
You see, I'm a product of a century which started at the height of class-conscious imperialism and ended with a society so reduced to totalitarian commonness that in my final years at college, the saying, mediocrity rises, became very popular. And being mediocre, I rose.
There was a big block of time there, Ray, where you were, you know, not putting out records, about 10 years or so. And I mean, were you still writing songs in that period of time? Is it something that you have to do to feel better about yourself or to get things out to write songs? Or was it just a case of you just stopped writing them at one point?
No, I never stopped writing. I think the 10 years you mean is the period between a Kinks album and this first solo album,
right,
which was about 10 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
No, I keep writing. It's just that Storyteller took up so much of my life. You know, it was like running in a play, like The Mousetrap or one of those long-running musicals. You know, you find yourself, they say, you do a tour. When I did Chicago first with it, I did 4 weeks somewhere. I enjoyed that, and I did that in Boston, New York for 4 weeks. So it tends to take up a longer, because it's more like a theatrical show. So that contributed towards it.
When you write, when you say you write, do you sit down with an instrument, a guitar, or are you just writing in a notebook, or how do the songs start for you usually?
I don't do so much note keeping as I used to. I build up, when I first started writing songs, nobody taught me how to do it, so I just ideas came along and I had a notebook, but very rarely wrote things down. Of course, then I didn't have a tape recorder, so I notated more when I started. I remember You Really Got Me. I notated that, wrote the music notes out.
That's an interesting concept because it's universally considered one of the simplest and greatest rock songs of all time. The idea of the notation of that.
Well, I'm not a very good notator.
Girl, you really got me going. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah, you really got me now. You got me so I can't sleep at night.
But then I went through a period, of course, home technology, because of the advent of digital technology. A lot of these songs were done on a on an electronic, you know, machine. But with the last album, Working Man's Cafe, and the one before it, I wrote a lot on acoustic guitar, because that's still my instrument. With the Kinks, I wrote acoustically, but always finished things on a keyboard. Which is maybe strange for you to hear.
Even those grunge-heavy guitar songs.
Well, You Really Got Me, which is and All Day and All of the Night, were written on a piano. And I started on a guitar. You know, I wrote You Really Got Me about 3 years, the riff and the chord structure, to You Really Got Me and Tired of Waiting for You, another single, about 3 years before the Kinks really recorded them. And they were written on guitar, like country blues tunes.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came to present it to the band, present the songs to the band, I just banged it out on the piano.
Well, we've got the guitars all tuned up, and Ray Davis is here, one of the great songwriters of all time. So how about a song, Ray?
We'll do our best, won't we?
All right.
Okay.
2, 3, 4. Thank you. for the working man's cafe in the shopping center of the town, looking for somewhere to fit in among the retail outlets. Bought a pair of new designer pants where the fruit and veg man used to stand. Always used to see him there selling old apples and pears, chatting up the pretty girls we knocked off goods in the van. Don't you know there was a working man long ago? We were a working man and we sat in the working man's cafe. The working man's cafe. Everything around me seems unreal. Everywhere I go it looks and feels like America. We've really come a long way down this road, improving our surroundings as we go, changing our roots and culture. But don't you know, long ago there was a working man. Don't you know, we were a working man. We met at the working man's cafe. The working man's cafe. Thought I knew you then, but will I know you now? There's gotta be a place for us to meet. I called you when I found it. I only hope that life has made us a little more grounded. Amen, see you now. Here we are at the working man's cafe. It's really good to see us come so far, but haven't we forgotten who we are? Taking out a larger loan, equity relief and mortgages. Now we spend the time of day online at the internet cafe. And if you forget my face, in case you've forgotten just who I am, I'm the kid with the greasy spoon firmly held in my hand. Don't you know I was a working man long ago? We were a working man and we sat and spent the time of day at the working man's cafe.
That is the song Working Man's Cafe by Ray Davis. Coming up next on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we will continue our conversation with the Kinks legend and great songwriter. And then Greg and I will review albums from Tokyo Police Club and Nick Cave.
We are the Village Green Preservation Society. God save the old duck for the bill and variety. We are the Desperate Dan Appreciation Society. God save strawberry jam and all the different varieties. Preserving the old ways from being abused. Protecting the new ways for me and for you. What more can we do? We are the Draft Beer Preservation Society. God save Mrs. Moss and good old Mother Riley. We are the Custard Pie Appreciation Consortium. God save the George Cross and all those who are loving them. We are the Sherlock Holmes English-speaking vernacular. God save Fu Manchu, Moriarty and Dracula. We are the office block, persecution affinity. God save little shots, China cups and virginity. We are the skyscrapers.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. We're going to continue our discussion with Kinks legend Ray Davis. In 2004, Ray was shot in the leg in New Orleans after trying to catch a purse thief, and I asked him how that experience played into the songwriting on his new record. You know, I was struck by the role that, you know, these songs play in your own life. I read some interviews with you where you're talking about even in your hospital bed after you got shot in New Orleans, you were asking for notebooks and saying, I need to write some songs. I need to write some music here.
Well, that was fear. I was wired up. I did get shot, and that was quite painful. But I had a problem with my heart rate, which was really slow. I remember saying to the guy in the hospital, "Don't worry, I used to be a runner, so that's why it's low." And athletes were meant to have a slower heart rate, but they were concerned it was quite low. And they were giving me all these tests, and seeing other people in the ward who were really in serious problems, difficulties. And I asked for a notepad, and I just wrote, and it turned out to be the Morphine song. And the only thing I changed in that from when I took the notepad back and wrote the song was one name that I didn't want to use, because that person didn't survive. Listen to my heartbeat.
Yeah, I'll fall down. Someone help me off of the ground.
Listen to my heartbeat.
Yeah, I'll fall down. Someone help me off of the ground.
Nelson and Star. He's got 10 grandkids. She's a third missus. He grooves around intensive care.
It's a serious song about a serious subject, and yet it has this very jaunty exterior. If you were just listening to it very casually, you say, wow, that's kind of an upbeat, peppy song. And yet it's about this incredibly... I mean, I take it that must have been intentional to sort of couch some of that fear inside this very jaunty arrangement.
Well, no, it's, if you think of the tonality, it's this little phrase. It's like the clown type music. You
know, yeah.
It's dancing on a sort of... imagined a ballerina dancing through the ward, charity ward, and the brass band coming through. You know, when you're that heavily medicated, it's not difficult to come to these sort of have these illusions. And but there's a serious element to it. But I've never tried to, even going back to the original songs, a song like Well Respected Man and one called Dedicated Follower of Fashion, both those songs were started off with serious, certainly Dedicated was a serious rant about fashion and people who, you know, each day is a new, something else is out of date, something else is in vogue. So I tried to spice up semi-serious elements with a bit of humor.
Yeah, I heard you mentioned Dedicated Follower of Fashion. The story I heard you tell, I think, at the Apollo wasn't that like a serious fight? You actually had a fight with somebody.
It was a quarrel over the advantage of between or disadvantages between wearing tight drain pipes and flares, and it was as simple as that. And this guy was quite high profile designer and thought I was out of date. I was still wearing the drain pipe, and he was in serious flares. And it did blow up, flare up into a big fight. And so I went back and wrote the song, and again that was first draft, no rewrites.
Wow.
Yeah.
They seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion.
That's, you know, that's one of your more lighthearted sociological observations, Ray, but it's almost a critical cliche. I know I've fallen prey to it. I think Mr. Cott has. Whenever we're looking at a songwriter who's trying to say something about the manners of the society around him, especially in England, but everybody gets this. You know, we always say it's Kinks like sociological observation. Did you ever want to be anything besides a songwriter? You know, you ever want to be a sociologist? Because you're so good at it.
Yeah. First target I get is to be a person. And have a life. But I'm interested in sociology, and I'm interested, you know, I think it's to grasp everything. I live in a world, I can't shut the world out, and I live in a world where things, events happen, and of course, like everybody else, I'm affected by it ultimately.
You know, the new album, the title song, Ray, is what a lot of people are describing as a classic Ray Davis song. The tonality of that song, the poignancy of that song, you know, to my mind, you could draw a straight line from like Waterloo Sunset to Working Man's Cafe. Do you feel like there is a, that is the Ray Davis voice, for lack of a better term, or do you feel like that's the voice that kind of defines you as a songwriter the most, maybe?
It's another character that I employ to do it. He's quite a wistful person who's longing for something. I was out last night looking for a little family Italian restaurant that I go whenever I come to Chicago. And I discovered it had been knocked down. It's now a block of corporate buildings. So I had to go to a chain. It's about the decline of the mom and pop mentality, the retail, you know, the small shops. It's Village Green Preservation Society set in Chicago. but I find, I wouldn't say it's a classic Ray Davis song. It's another version of a Ray Davis that is this person aware, fully aware that the world is changing, but longing. I wish, say, my daughter or my kids could have experienced that little Italian restaurant that disappeared.
Mm. I think that's the beautiful feeling, though, that something is passing that you will never be able to recapture. And that was there from a very early age, it seemed like. Even when you were a very young man, you seemed to understand, you know, that something was lost.
Yeah, but the secret is not to dwell on it, but acknowledge that it was there and it exists. And so it's a way of sort of engaging. You know, again, I don't want to be a historian, but it's just this character wandering through a neighborhood that doesn't really exist anymore.
Well, you've also said, and this is inevitable in every interview, we have to ask you, you've also said that you've had some thoughts about reuniting the Kinks, in particular to do some classic albums, maybe like an Arthur, reuniting that band, or the band of Come Dancing, reuniting a particular era of the group.
Yeah, I do that, and it's a very popular thing for people to do. I think Lou Reed did Berlin in England recently. Mm-hmm. But I'd also like to make new music. I think I don't want to just do it for nostalgia reasons. But it would be nice to get the shows Arthur presented. This summer I'm doing a big show in London using a choir, and I'm doing elements from Arthur and Village Green that have never been performed before. But it would be nice to reunite the bands. But I really would like to do it with the intention of, yes, do the songs that they worked on together. But at the same time, see what we would come up with now. And I'd like to sit down with the original guys and say, what would we have written? What would we have done if we hadn't had You Really Got Me, which was our first English number one? Hmm. So see what they would come up with.
Well, it's interesting. Your relationship with that band is one of the great stories in rock. And you know, when I interviewed you about 15 years ago, I asked you about that, the whole idea that there was sort of this love-hate thing going on. You said if we'd all been friends, if everyone was patting each other on the back, we wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes. Mm. Hate is the only thing that lasts.
Well, that maybe I was plugging one of the songs on the album. But certainly intensity, you know. It's the old thing. It's the third man, isn't it? It's Orson Welles' great speech. You know, you need conflict to produce great art sometimes. But it is I found that the intensity between the Kinks sometimes are very creative. If Dave, my brother Dave on guitar, was sort of ranting, going mad, I say, okay, do it. You always have to press the record button. When he goes in the studio, he'll get it first time. And maybe, you know, I could manipulate that a bit. Mm-hmm. But you just can't legislate for people's actions. And that was a great thing about the Kinks, is they're unpredictable. And certainly that the work is more diverse than most other of our contemporaries. You know, we didn't stick to the same thing. We changed. I remember RCA Records, we did Soap Opera Preservation and all those mad albums. And the head of the company said, yeah, this is great, but can we have two albums consecutively that sound the same?
Well, when you were talking there, race and conflict and tension and unpredictability, speaking as a man who hasn't talked to his own brother in 3 years since we got in a fist fight at my folks' anniversary party, I got to say that there's a certain kind of conflict and tension that can only come from a sibling. That's the other great trope. In addition to being rock's great sociologist, we have consistently found, you know, when we're writing about Oasis and every other brother band since, we have to refer to that thing. But like, what is it? Like, can you and Dave get together and just go to the pub and have a pint and not talk about business or Kinks? I mean, like, do you still work as brothers or is it only as collaborators?
Interestingly, I didn't spend much time with Dave when we were early in our lives. I lived with my older sister for many years, and I think there's something missing in our dynamics. So we knew, we got to know one another when we joined the band. So we don't have that normal brother relationship. But it is hard not to, you know, when Dave got sick, he had a stroke about just after I got shot, and he came to stay with me with his girlfriend, and I really enjoyed having him in this, under the same roof. It was good to be with him because, you know, we'd watch movies together and not play music, but we have lots of humor in common, and he is fun to be around. It's actually music where it gets heated.
Well, what else is there worth fighting about? It's our whole radio show is based on that.
Yeah. But I did like having him around. But he left and wanted to find his own place to live, which is fine. But he's always welcome under my roof.
Where are you at with Dave? I mean, is Dave healthy enough where he could start playing music again? And I know you've talked a little bit about doing the Kinks again. I mean, where do you see that happening?
When I get back off this tour, I'll take a few days off, then I'll see him. And he's ready to start recording, I think. He just doesn't want to spend a long time in the studio. But with modern technology, that can be sorted out. So I'm hopeful that we can get together. But I couldn't possibly think of doing anything with that name, the brand name, Kinks, without having him involved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of that, can you pinpoint, I mean, I think this is one of the great questions in terms of your songwriting, and maybe you don't see it as big of a transition as some people might, but that transition from You Really Got Me and All Day and All of the Night into that well-respected man, David Watts, dedicated follower of fashion songwriting, I mean, it was like a quantum leap in terms of what you wanted to do with a song. It seemed like nothing wrong with You Really Got Me, an amazing piece of music, but there was, I don't know, do you see that as a pretty broad transition there, Ray, or was it just a continuum for you?
You know, I didn't expect to be a songwriter. I wrote You Really Got Me and Tired of Waiting just for my own, you know, pleasure. And after You Really Got Me, people thought, oh, he knows how to do it, and I didn't. It was one of the first songs I'd written. So it was all about learning. It was an experiment. It was a wonderful time, I have to say. It was great with all the other bands around, like the Beatles and later on The Who, listening to what they were doing. And so we were all like explorers, you know. And technology was very basic, so we used it to its extreme. We used distortion and feedback, and so did The Who. And it was a wonderful time of experimentation.
We're talking to Ray Davis here on Sound Opinions. What a treat. I mean, Greg, there are days when you and I should just give back our salary. Not that we get paid, but it's because now Ray is going to play us a song, right, Ray?
Yeah, for free.
Yeah, we're all doing this for free.
And it sounds like it's for free. It should be. This very relaxed version of a song from Working Man's Cafe.
Get the top of your suntan, otherwise your skin's gonna turn to leather. We made a movie in Vietnam, tax break said we're gonna shoot on location. The rug says made in Korea, manufactured in a factory using cheap labor. And all over Asia, third world becoming a major league player. Mass production in Saigon, while art and work is laid off in Cleveland. Hot jacuzzi in Taiwan, with empty factories in Birmingham. Now it's
baby boomers in Hong Kong and cowboys in Vietnam making their movies. Big confusion in Hollywood, now it's American Major League in Japan, hamburger in China with sushi bars in Maine and Boston. The dollar sign said expand, now it's cowboys in Vietnam making their movies. Let's make a movie in Vietnam. Top of the suntan, looks like we're in for heavy weather. Economic meltdown, nobody said it would last forever. Ooh. Make a movie in Baghdad, take the culture right to the third world, blow up a brand new civilization in the name of globalization. Big confusion in Hollywood, now it's American Major League in Japan, hamburger in China with sushi bars in Maine and Boston. The baller sign said expand, now it's cowboys in Vietnam making a move. Ride off with your debts into the sunset.
Vietnam Cowboys from Ray Davis on Sound Opinions. Beautiful.
'Cause he gets up in the morning and he goes to work at 9, and he comes back home at 5:30, gets the same train every time.
We've been talking to Ray Davis on Sound Opinions. Thank you so much, Ray.
That's my pleasure.
It never fails. And he's all so good. And he's all so fine. And he's all.
To contact Sound Opinions, sign up for our newsletter. Or to listen to archived shows, you can go to soundopinions.org. We're going to be back after a short break on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with reviews of new albums by Tokyo Police Club and Nick Cave.
While his father pulls the main, and she stirs the tea with counselors while discussing foreign trade, and she passes looks as well as bills at every suave young man. 'Cause he's all so good, and he's all so fine, and he's all so healthy in his body and his mind. He's a well-respected man.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That's a track called Graves from the debut album by Tokyo Police Club, an album called Elephant Shell. Tokyo Police Club, they are not from Tokyo. They have nothing to do with the cops. They're not a club. They're just four high school friends from Ontario who on Friday nights got together. All their previous bands had broken up, and then on Friday nights they were just getting together as a lark to make some music, play for some friends. Actually went into a recording studio to knock out four or five songs, released it as an EP, again, thinking only a few hundred people would hear it. That 16-minute debut EP called A Lesson in Crime ended up selling 40,000 copies, getting all sorts of notice in the blogosphere, got well-reviewed by publications like Pitchfork, and led to a record deal. The band got signed to Saddle Creek Records, the home of bands like Bright Eyes and Cursive, and now they have a debut album out called Elephant Shell. Produced by Peter Kattis of Interpol and the national fame, as well as John Drew, a producer who's done a lot of work in that Canadian indie rock scene. Let's play a track from the new Tokyo Police Club record before we review it. It's called Your English Is Good on Sound Opinions.
English Is Good by Tokyo Police Club from their first full album, Elephant Shell. Greg, you were all over these guys when you first saw them at South by Southwest, and you loved the two EPs that preceded this full album. I didn't dislike them. I have the same problem, though, with this album that I have had with them from the beginning. It's hard to figure out where they fit. That's not a bad thing, you know? I mean, there are elements of the new wave of new wave. There are bits of pop punk and garage rock and power pop. Who are these guys? What are they trying to do? It was only with this album because it's a little longer. I mean, the last EP was eight songs in 18 minutes. It was like, whew, it was gone, right? Yep. This is a little bit longer, not much.
Not much.
You get to live with it, and you start to realize what this band is about is just about the songs, pure and simple, writing great melodies and delivering them with high energy and exuberance. In that regard, I think if there's a predecessor, it might be like XTC at its poppiest. They do occasionally step over a line into indie rock pretentiousness. I'm thinking of a song like Tessellate, where they're singing Dead Lovers Salivate, Broken Hearts Tessellate Tonight. I had to look it up. Tessellate means to form a mosaic, all right? It's like, well, yeah, all right, maybe put away the Thesaurus kids and just concentrate on the melodies a little more. But overall, I have to say this is a buy-it record. It's a great burst of enthusiastic pop.
Well, it's 11 songs in 28 minutes, and you don't get many of those anymore. I mean, it's barely longer than the EP. What I liked was the very tightly constructed arrangements. They said what they had to say, and they got out right away, and that's the case here. They're combining sort of that celebratory vibe that bands like the Arcade Fire and Broken Social Scene would bring to the indie rock world, and combining it with these really tight band-based songs by bands like Interpol and The Strokes. They don't have a lot to say. That was my big problem with the EPs. In this record, they're trying to be a little bit more elliptical. You know, you bring up the word like tessellate, yeah, you know, just throwing it in there. They're basically a bunch of guys pining for the girl they didn't get in high school. That's what these songs are still about. No big deal. They're young guys. They're going to grow into it. But the sound is exuberant. I love the enthusiasm they bring to it. Each one of these songs has a cool little hook or melody line in it. And, you know, it's over in two and a half minutes per song. So I love that brevity. I love the fact that they realize, hey, we're not that great yet. we're just going to give you this burst of energy, and then we're going to get out.
Well,
a lot of
great keyboard work, too. The conversations that are happening between the guitar and the keyboard is something you're not hearing a lot of in indie rock anymore. Keyboards are done as a wash, right? They never deliver the hook. These guys are bringing it back to a more like 60s or 70s power pop.
And then you'll get the instruments dropping out, and it'll just be a bass line or these exuberant little hand claps in there. And those are kind of like cool little touches. So, you know, I can't really say buy this thing.
Really? I'm saying buy it, and you're not?
You're the one saying buy it. I'm saying, you know, it's not transcending its influences yet. But I like this band. I would say it's a burn it. And I think this band is going to make more good records to come. I think they're going to grow into a great band. They're not there yet.
Nest up in the autumn branches, built from nothing but high hopes and thin air. He collected up some baby blasted mothers, they took their chances, and for a while they lived quite happily up there. I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on upstairs.
Yes, that is Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds with the title track of their 14th studio album, Dig! Lazarus, dig! I'm saying it that way because there's 3 exclamation points after both of those digs in the title. Who is Nick Cave? He has been with us since the mid-70s when he led a band out of Australia called The Birthday Party. And as far as I'm concerned, he's never given us anything that was completely without merit. There have been Nick Cave albums that are better than others, and there are some that have been just pure masterpieces, including, I would say, last year's one-off, just kind of for yucks side project, Grinderman. The self-titled Grinderman album was my album of the year. That was a very small combo, like 4 pieces. Bad Seeds are a big sprawling ensemble. It's got violin, it's got percussion, it's got, you know, drums and bass and guitar, all that stuff, and then a whole lot more. With the Bad Seeds, when we last heard from them in 2004, it was with a sprawling double album, very moody and piano ballad heavy, Abattoir Blues, The Lyre of Orpheus. One of my least favorite Bad Seeds records, and I attributed the lack of excitement to the departure of Blixa Bargeld. This is one of the great German characters in rock history. He led a band called Einstürzende Neubauten, forefathers of the industrial thrash movement, and he and Cave on stage were a great team. They played off each other. He was Cave's main foil. But I have to say that with Grinderman, Warren Ellis really stepped to the fore. Ellis is a violinist primarily, known for the Dirty Three, his combo of his own. He's been a member of the Bad Seeds for some time, but with Nick Cave on Dig Lazarus Dig, it is truly a Lou Reed-John Cale relationship. They are bringing out the nastiest in one another, spurring each other on to greater and greater outrage. Cave's always had a couple of central obsessions. It's sex, Old Testament, and American mythology. Those issues collide in a big way throughout this album. Let's hear a track. Always a good sign on Sound Opinions when we had a 5-minute fight about which song we were going to play. You won. It's Albert Goes West by the Bad Seeds with Nick Cave on Sound Opinions.
Albert, he goes west. He crosses the fast different deserts in Arizona. Oh yeah. He had a psychotic episode on the dude ranch that involved a bottle of ammonia. Henry, he went south and lost his way deep in the weeping forest. I've been over. He grew so warm, he grew so sick. He ended up in a bungalow, sucking a revolver. A light upon your rainy streets, half as many reflections. I won't be held responsible for my actions. Bobby, he goes north and he goes east and over to New Hampshire. Bobby is a cautious man. He walked into a Concord
Albert Goes West from the 14th studio album by Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Dig Lazarus Dig. What an album. You know, this band, it's hard to believe, but, you know, he's now in his 50s, Nick Cave.
Yeah.
And at a time when guys should be slowing down or maybe getting into their introspective phase, you know, he's married, he's got two kids, he got off heroin a few years ago, he's really, you know, he should be settled down.
Let us remember that at age 50, Paul McCartney gave us Off the Ground, and Dylan gave us Wiggle Wiggle, and Cave is now 50, and he's giving us Dig Lazarus Dig.
That's good perspective, because that is what should be happening to Nick Cave, and somehow he has seemed to reverse the aging process. And I think what's happening here, Jim, you said it well. I mean, sex, death, God, that's always been huge elements in his
little
music.
Little subjects.
They've always been there. And they're in this record in spades. There's no doubt about it. But I think what has happened to Nick Cave and what has re-energized him, two things. There's an element of humor that I'm hearing in his music that wasn't as pronounced in the past.
He's getting funnier.
He is. I mean, he's cracking me up. He's taking this drama that he's bringing to this music, and he's having fun with it. Dig Lazarus Dig is about a poor guy who doesn't want to be resurrected.
Yeah,
he ends up getting
back.
Like, why do you want me to go through this again and then die again?
He winds up a junkie in New York. Yeah.
I mean, it's a sad tale, but at the same time, it's kind of tragically funny. And that thread is throughout this record. The second thing is they find this weird sense of pop hooks. A lot of these songs are three chords, but you've got these pop hooks, like as in Albert Goes West, those sha-la-la wordless backing harmonies over this just outrageously overfed Mick Harvey guitar that is just like poisonous in the background, and yet you've got this pop thing going over the top. So between the pop element and the humor, Cave has added a few elements to his game, and he has re-energized his music, and this is a great record. This is a buy-it record.
He just gets better and better. You know, once in a while I'm frustrated by the four-star system the Sun-Times uses. I've long advocated that for special occasions, we need 4.5 stars. It's like an A-plus when the teacher says, you not only got your A, you went above and beyond. Grinder Man was a 4.5 star, an A-plus record. This is merely an A record, okay? But what is that saying? This is a brilliant, brilliant record. As you said, melody, noise, smarts. You know, he's name-checking in one verse Charles Bukowski, the poet Berryman, and Ernest Hemingway, and he's being funny about it, not pretentious. This is a brilliant, brilliant record. You need this record, and even more, you need to see the big band of the Bad Seeds live, because they will, I promise you, shear the top of your head off.
I guess that's an emphatic double buy it for Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
You know it.
Next week, Jim, we're going to be talking about bands and artists who have been one-note wonders throughout their careers. And we're going to be talking to some listeners as well to give us their candidates. Bands and artists who have sustained careers by basically doing one thing really, really well.
Absolutely. Greg, we have some thank yous to say. Sound Opinions, as always, is produced by the ace team of Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, Robin Lynn, and intern Dave Mahler. Our conversation and the performance by Ray Davis was recorded by Mary Gaffney. And our fearless leader and executive producer is Tori Southside Malatia, who we love even though he's failed every attempt to audition for American Idol. Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. Now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Mr. Telephone Man, there's something wrong with my line. When I dial my baby's number, I get a click every time.
New messages.
Hello, my name's Charlie. I'm calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I wanted to thank Greg for his Desert Island Jukebox selection on the March 31st show. It was the Pixies' Where Is My Mind.
Where is my mind? Where is my mind? Where is my mind?
I'm a tired father of a 4.5-month-old son who does not like to sleep. And I was driving to work in the pitch dark, and I had a feeling he was going to pick that song, and it was just like, as soon as it came on, like, God, this is me. This is my life right now. Where is my mind? So it perks me up a little bit. Thank you very much, Greg.
We have been on the air, head all around.
Yeah, hi. This is Todd Hayward calling from Chicago. I just wanted to comment on the segment that you guys played on Disappear. It's just a shining example of why I love your guys' show. Little gems like this pop up that just make my day. Personally, I'm a really old-school Discharge fan from 1982. So when you were talking about the D-beat and what was going on with that, I knew exactly what you were talking about. Thanks for taking my comments.
Yes, my name is Margie. I'm from Rome, New York. And I'm calling about this Swedish band, and you keep talking about how wonderful they sound. I think that is the most obnoxious music. I don't understand why anybody would want to hear it. I obviously believe that these people that play this type of music have a lot of issues emotionally and mentally, because anybody who wants to just sit there and play loud music and scream is trying to vent in some way, and the people listening to them, God bless you, because they suck.
My name is Barbara Janeway in Carrboro, North Carolina, and I want to say how much I enjoyed Sound Opinion's discussion about Disappear, Swedish metal. I am 57 years old. I'm an ex-hippie. I've never even liked metal, and I loved your review about Disappear, and I loved the cut that you played. It was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Hey, this is Mike in Oakland, California. Boy, did I feel like a big dummy. I heard that Tim Fight was going to be on the show, and I remember thinking to myself, oh, that's that hip-hop guy, whatever. And then they started playing, and it sounded like Nickel Creek or something, and I was like, huh? And then there's vocal harmony, like really nice vocal harmony, and I turned it up really loud. And then suddenly there's like a Radiohead break. And then back to the vocal harmony and the Nickel Creek thing, and then busts out in hard rock, and that finale gave me goosebumps. So if Tim Fight never wants to hear anybody talking about Shaniqua again, more power to him. Let's not bother him with that. The guy's making some serious music.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.